Well, good morning. Good morning, and what a wild morning it has been so far. All the scandal and confusion, I guess, is the... Nobody's quite sure what's going on at the auditor's office with the, you know, that, what is it, that scheme from, there's a country over in Africa where you always get these schemes from, where somebody says, hey, put $200 in your credit cards and send me this, and there's all sorts of crud there. I didn't quite figure out, and listening to Scott's previous discussions with Ayers and also the mayor, what the benefit for the person who told that auditor person to go buy these gift cards. I didn't quite figure out what the benefit for the guy who was running the scam was going to be, but that's not for me. I've learned that if you haven't entered the Irish lottery, you probably haven't won it. So if you haven't, if you have no reason to get free money, you probably haven't won something, right? Be careful. Be really careful. When I was working at the credit union, we got lots of people. And my boss would always say to me, well, we need to tell them. Well, there's only so long you can tell people not to be stupid. I fell for one of those scams, one of those things where, well, like what the government was falling for here in the United States, where they threatened to cut off your internet if you don't pay them a certain amount of money. Well, I kind of fell for that, but I was lucky enough that I was able to figure out how to get out of it, but... there's lots of people that don't have any concern about honesty, and unfortunately our society right now is not giving a whole lot of benefit to those of us who believe in honesty, and honesty, I guess, is in the eye of the beholder. Is that right? I can't imagine that people don't know when they're being dishonest, but apparently there are some people that don't know that. Anyway, today I have a great guest on at 11:15. He's one of my favorite. No, he is my favorite guest. And I'll tell all my other guests that this is my favorite guest. Happens to be my son. Now, my son has, I think, written 11 books. They're all sci-fi stuff. We had him on about a year ago talking about, at that time he had only written 3. But we're going to ask him how you can get published by yourself. And he does self-publishing. Now, it's not a free thing. I didn't know that. I thought, well, you just get online and you can self-publish for nothing. No, there's a little bit of outlay, and also there's a lot of work. Christopher told me that he gets up at 6:30 every morning, spends an hour and a half. No, 5:30? Well, anyway, spends an hour and a half writing every day, and that's why he's been able to write so many books in such a short period of time. He figures he puts down about 1,500 to 2,000 words every day. That's a lot of words. And I would guess, I wrote my memoir, and it's about 160-some pages. His are about twice that long. I think mine is close to... 60,000 words, something like that. So his is probably double that. Anyway, he's going to talk to us about how you can get out there, how you can publish your stuff. And he doesn't have any. Well, he did graduate from OU with a major in creative writing, I believe. We'll ask him that. You'd think a dad would know that, wouldn't you? No, I just shut up, paid the bills, and my wife knew all that stuff. We'll talk to him about how you can get involved in. If you think you're a writer, why not try it? It's really not that. You can get into it at zero cost. It just doesn't go anywhere. You really need to get involved with... he sells his books on Amazon and... so there is a little bit of money, but it's, you know, less than $100 Well, I don't know. We'll have to ask him. All right. So today, this morning, before he comes on, I thought it'd be interesting to ask some questions about other writers that we all know about. And then I pulled up this site, 250 questions that you should know about writers. Half of the writers I had never heard of. Now, you all know that I don't read, right? Including, I don't read my son's books, and he knows that. The dyslexia I have causes me to fall asleep after reading for about 10 minutes, so it's really quite a chore for me. But now my wife reads every one of them, and then she tells me who killed whom and how that guy got out of that tussle and, you know, all that sort of thing. But I don't read, so therefore I really don't know writers very well. Now, I've read several books that I had to read for college, but and high school, but not nearly the amount of books that I would have liked to have read when I was a youngster. My dad gave me the five foot bookshelf of classics. And that includes everything from Socrates to Shakespeare to, it's every famous name in writing you've ever heard of, and it's, I would guess it's about 70 books. They're all blue-bound leather, and they're in a three-tier case, a wooden case, which is beautiful. I have it sitting in my spare bedroom, and rarely do I go in there and pull one out. Now, I have read, there's one in there about James Whitcomb Riley. I've read several of those, and he's a Hoosier poet, and that's what got me interested in him. But even with that, most of his stuff is fairly long, his poetry, and I have to pace myself when I read that sort of thing. But we're going to ask some questions or answer some questions. This is not a trivia contest. It is trivia, but we're not going to ask you to call in. Some of these questions, I had to look up who they were. Many of them I just didn't put in here because I didn't have any idea and never heard of the person. So we're going to ask some questions. Most of these, you will know one or the other of the writers that we're talking about, right? Okay, the first one, Harriet Beecher Stowe. Now, you know that name. Author of Uncle Tom's Cabin. Now, you know who she is? All right. Anyway, do you know that she lived right next door to Mark Twain? I didn't know that. That's kind of cool. How do you get that much writing intelligence in one block? Less, not even one block, two doors, two houses. Interesting. I have read Uncle Tom's Cabin, and I've read several of Mark Twain's things, but when it comes to long books, I'm not really good with reading the 600 page. I tried one time reading, what was the name of that book? Everybody would know it. It's about 1,200 pages long. I got through about page 20 and hung it up. Anyway, okay, in 1974, Arthur C. Clarke predicted. Now, Arthur C. Clarke is, you know him by all his stuff that he, his sci-fi stuff that he's written. Anyway, he predicted the internet he expected it. In 2001. Now, it came a little earlier than that, but he predicted it in 1974. So, pretty smart guy when it comes to science and writing about predicting really outlandish things. I can remember as a kid, I would have thought I was dreaming had I ever thought we were going to have an internet. I remember buying my very first computer, which was a TRS-80, which was made by Radio Shack. You had to buy everything, and you had to learn how to program it. It was kind of tough, but I had it for about 2 years, and I used it to do a lot of statistics when I bought it right before I became before I started working at a university, and one of my jobs at the university was to maintain the records of basketball players and so forth. And so therefore, I was able to use that computer to maintain that, and it really helped me out. I was one of the very first people to use a computer to maintain that sort of stat amongst many of the big universities. I think I was way ahead of Michigan, OSU. I'm sure I was ahead. The one person I knew that was probably even with me was the sports information director down at Kentucky. He was pretty good. But we also had stuff like we didn't communicate via phone line. Well, we did communicate via phone lines, but they were called, what were they called? Anyway, it would take 6 minutes to transmit a picture of whatever you wanted to send to somebody. And the bad part about it is you had to use that paper that burns when you put spark on it. So it stunk to high heaven. But that's the way we passed teleprompter. Oh, shoot, I can't remember the name of the thing. Anyway, that's the way we passed statistics between universities back then. It took a while. You would go to bed, or you would finish a basketball game, go to your office, hand do all the statistics, because you didn't have computers doing it for you at the court side like they do now, and you'd hand do them, and then you would type them up, put them on that paper, run them through that machine to every school that you had promised that you were going to send stats to. So you got to go home. In my case, since I lived a two-hour train ride from my home, I'd get home at 3 o'clock in the morning. it was interesting. I enjoyed it, though. I wish I was still young enough to do it. All right. Stieg Larsson said that the girl with the dragon tattoo was based on what Pippi Longstocking would have been like had she grown up to be an adult. That's kind of interesting. Now, I've read neither one of those things, but I do know the names of both of those. Kind of interesting that some books were based on other characters and other people's writings. Anyway, let's continue on. Playwright Tennessee Williams. Now, I did do some, when I was studying to be an actor, I did several Tennessee Williams readings. But do you know how he passed away? He choked to death on a bottle cap. What a horrible way to die. And why in the world did he have a bottle cap in his mouth? That's the, I don't know. People do strange stuff, don't they? The author of The Hunger Games, Suzanne Collins, was one of the writers on the 1990 children's TV show Clarissa Explains It All. Going for that's quite a move from The Hunger Games to a children's show. Hunger Games is kind of a scary book. Before settling on the pen name Mark Twain, Samuel Langhorne Clements. Now, the reason why I read his full name is I had never heard his middle name was Langhorne. I knew him as Sam Adams or Sam Clements, but I did not know it. Yeah, Sam Adams is a beer, also a patriot, I guess. Mark Twain, I knew his nom de plume was Samuel Clements, but I didn't know it was Samuel Langhorne Clements. He signed, that was his real name. Mark Twain was his nom de plume. He signed his writings with the pseudonym Josh. That doesn't seem like a whole lot of forethought or deep thought or anything. Josh? Okay. I got to take a sip of coffee. Can you hang on just 1 second? Okay, thanks. that's good coffee this morning. I did a good job today. Before finding fame as a novelist, Dan Brown, who wrote The Da Vinci Code, kind of a scary show, book. I watched the movie. That's how I read a lot. I watched the movie, right? Sometimes you get the whole thing. Sometimes you just get thrown out of there. But Dan Brown was a pop singer. One of his solo albums was called Angels and Demons. Kind of interesting, considering that he did the Da Vinci Code. Angel and Demons. Did you know that? Dan Brown, the pop singer, author. Washington Irving, who wrote both Rip Van Winkle and The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. I remember being terrified in grade school. Every Halloween, for some reason or other, we had sadistic teachers who would put The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. And the reason why it was sadistic is the one that we always had, there were heads being chopped off and all sorts of stuff like that. I'm not sure they're being chopped off, but somehow or other people were losing their heads, as well as legend, the guy who ran around, bounced around on his horse with his head under his arm, I guess. Anyway, did you know that the guy that wrote that, and I can imagine why he had this problem, he suffered from insomnia. You write about things like Legend of Sleepy Hollow, you can understand why you might have a little insomnia. Oh, holy cow. All right. Here's another one. F. Scott Fitzgerald once danced on the lawn of Publishers Doubleday to attract Joseph Conrad. The caretaker noticed him and had him removed. Now, obviously, this was before F. Scott Fitzgerald became famous. But he, you know, there are a lot of things. I'll have to ask Christopher when Christopher comes on if he ever did anything to get noticed. As a matter of fact, I'm going to put a little check mark next to this and ask him if he ever did anything like F. Scott Fitzgerald. We will ask him. I don't think he has. I think he's pretty much just sent them in, and he has sent several in which have not been purchased. But the 11 that he now has published were self-published. When he worked for Faber, T.S. Eliot liked to seat visiting authors in chairs with whoopee cushions and offer them exploding cigars. Now, if you ever read T.S. Eliot, that makes perfect sense. I used to really like his stuff because it was funny and made you kind of get that smile of the Cheshire Cat. Noel Coward claimed he began every day by checking the obituary column in the Times. If he wasn't listed, he could get down to work. Now, that's a really old tale, but I wonder if it started with Noel Coward saying that. I think just about everybody in their 60s or 70s has said that to their kids. I look in the obituary to make sure I'm still here. Kind of boring, but also kind of interesting that Noel Coward claimed that he did that every day. One wonders if he did it every day. Agatha Christie. Now, my wife and I have started watching this on BritBox. We watch it every week. Poirot. Anyway, Agatha Christie created Hercule Poirot. But she hated him. She called him a detestable, bombastic, tiresome, egocentric little creep. And if you've ever watched it on BritBox, he is all of the above. But he has the actor pulls it off with such a cute smile, I guess you'd call it, that you really kind of fall in love with Hercule Poirot. Yeah, I can't say it the way he says it, but it's a very interesting show. it's kind of a, well, it's a mystery show, and it's kind of a soft mystery. There, somebody always gets killed, and Poirot goes out to find out who, what happened, but there's not lots of violence in it. My wife and I watch shows like that. We watch Death in Paradise, which sounds like it would be very violent. But Death in Paradise, you know the person's going to get killed in the first 5 minutes. And from then on, it's just, it's kind of funny and kind of interesting. And it takes place in the Caribbean, so it's beautiful. I mean, the scenery on it is absolutely beautiful. If you have a chance to watch Death in Paradise, you need to go to it and watch it just once, just for the scenery. We watch it every night. That's what we eat dinner to. I know, that's why I'm so fat. You should not eat while you're watching TV. You shouldn't watch TV while you're eating, because you just tend to keep stuffing your face. But anyway, we do watch that, and we enjoy it quite a bit. And at my age, nobody cares whether I'm a little on the pudgy side. Well, my kids do. But anyway, a young Samuel Johnson was turned down for a teaching job because it was feared his way of distorting his face would scare pupils. Excuse me. That's kind of interesting. I used to try to, when I was substitute teaching for a couple years, I used to try to figure out how to, excuse me, Allison, we're getting dust in here. I used to try to figure out how to make my face look more devastating, more confrontational. You know, I wanted to scare those kids into being nicer. Molière died after collapsing on stage while acting in one of his own plays. I did not know that either. Ironically, he was playing the role of a hypochondriac. Boy, interesting. But he actually died on stage. Pretty crazy. I've died on stage several times, but it had nothing to do with actually physically dying. I remember one time we were doing a, trying to think of what the show was. It was one of those really boring, supposedly brilliant plays, and I cannot remember. It wasn't Death of the Salesman, but it was something along that line as far as notoriety goes. We were doing it, and it was so boring that all of the actors forgot where we were online. We had a prompter, and she had lost her place. That's how boring it was. So we had to pull the curtain closed, run over to the prompter, find out where we were, and start from that point. Now, we tried to make it look like we pulled the curtain closed on purpose, but in fact, all of us had lost our place, and none of us knew what the next line was. So we ran over to the prompter, and she got us back in line, and we did. But boy, that was embarrassing. Whew. Probably an actor's worst nightmare is to forget where he is and not figure out how to get back in. Now, I was told when I was Charlie Brown in a production of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, and we were going to a national contest. Our university was one of, I think, four universities that got selected to do be in this contest, and we were being judged by, let's see, the Chicago Tribune, the Milwaukee Journal, and one of the Washington newspapers. So it was big time. And at the end of the thing, we got through it fine. At the end of the show, the critic from, I think, the Chicago Tribune said, and now remember, I was Charlie Brown, said, "It was a wonderful production of Charlie Brown, but it would have been far better if Charlie could have remembered his lines." I basically because of my dyslexia and my reading problem and my problem of memorization, I really am not a good memorizer. Because of all those problems, quite often I just kind of faked my way through. I would be close. The lines were close, but sometimes they kind of threw my co-actors off because I wouldn't give them their cue line. I don't remember ever getting in too much trouble as far as not giving the right cue line. I did several plays with David Ruprecht, who you might remember was the announcer on Supermarket Sweep. You still see him occasionally on cable. And we've gotten back as friends again. I've did a couple of shows, and that used to aggravate the heck out of David when I would not give him his cue line, because he was a very good actor. He was also the son of on Gilligan's Island, the son of the guy that was the rich guy. He was the son there. Anyway, where are we? Okay, it's 10:40, by the way. You're listening to WWGH. At 11:15, we will bring my son on the air, and he will talk about how you self-publish. And he'll talk about, I'm going to ask him about his 11 books that he's published now. Last time we talked to him about a year ago, he had only published 3. Now he's up to 11. We had a great day with him last week down at his house in Worthington. He lives on a, in his backyard, it drops way down into a gully that is a drainage area. It's beautiful. It's covered with trees and everything. And it goes into the Scioto River. And he always has deer out there, but usually it's just one, just laying around doing nothing. He had 3 little boys. They were big boy deer. And my granddaughter said, "Come on, Grandpa, let's go out and say hi to him." Okay. So we walked out, and this one very large male deer started walking right towards us. It looks like we have a phone call. Let's go to the phone and see what we have, okay? All right. Hi, you're on the air. How can we help you?
Well, good morning, Glenn. I was listening to your show on my way to the grocery store, and then I had to stop and go in the store, and I missed the part you were talking, going to start talking about authors.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to kind of let your listeners know, because I think sometimes people don't remember or forget or never knew about Louis Brumfield.
Okay, give us the down low.
I'm sorry?
Give us the down low on
him. Well, you know, he was probably the most famous author of his time in the 30s and 40s. He wrote 31 books in 30 years. He won the Pulitzer Prize. Most of his books were novels. However, he did write 5 nonfiction books,
okay,
basically about the farming and farm-related things and Malabar Farm itself.
Yep.
Wrote literally hundreds and hundreds of magazine articles, hundreds of short stories, and as I said, he was the most prolific and the highest paid author of his time during the 30s and 40s. He was making over $1 million a year, and
to
translate that to today's dollars, you're talking somewhere between $10 and $12 million a year that he was
holy
making.
Cow.
So,
now my son
he
is
spent it, you know, as fast as he made it.
Yeah.
But, and he also wrote screenplays for 12 different movies. Most of them were made into long movies. And, of course, the most famous one was The Rains Came, which starred Myrna Loy and Tyrone Power.
Wow,
and that
big,
was,
big names.
That was, came out in the same year that The Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind, two of the most famous movies, of course, of all times. And it won an Oscar for special effects in competition with Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz. So that in itself speaks quite a bit of his talent.
Well, I'm not sure if you were listening when I said my son is going to come on.
And I knew that. You and I think talked about that before, and I'm going to be listening when he comes on with you thereafter.
Well, now he's written 11 books. Does that mean he's going to be a millionaire in the next year?
You know, I don't know.
He's not one now, by the way.
I'm not a very good prognosticator at this particular point. And you know, people tend to forget Lloyd because his fame, as I said, he was very popular in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. He quit writing. Of course, he died in 1956. So his style of writing kind of went out of favor by the early 50s.
Oh, that's interesting.
But people, he was a contemporary of people like F. Scott Fitzgerald,
right.
Papa Hemingway, they were friends, people like Gertrude Stein, Edna Ferber, Pearl S. Buck, they all ran in the same circles that he did. And many of them, of course, came to Malabar over the years, which is just over in the neighboring county of Richland County.
Yeah.
So anyone that's never been to Malabar should take a day trip over, tour the big house, 31, 32 rooms, I forget.
Exactly. Is it fully open now, Fred?
June 1st, yes. Okay. They opened for tours. So they actually started tours, I think, on Sunday.
Okay.
They jumped it just a little bit. But it's really a shame that his legacy in the United States has faded away, because we still... And thanks to the family, we have all the rights to publish his books now.
Oh, that's good.
Those were all signed over to us when the last child died just a year or so ago. So we have the rights to publish all the books. And believe it or not, he is still very popular in Europe.
Huh.
We get a lot of requests for publishing books from European publishing companies. And we still get royalties every month from the publishing of those books.
That's fantastic.
So, he's very well known in Europe still to this day, but unfortunately his popularity in the United States has waned and isn't really that well known. And what really upsets me, and this is my pet peeve for the day,
okay,
and I'll get off my soapbox, but if you go to the Barnes & Noble store in Mansfield or Ontario, whatever you want to call it, there on Lexington Spring Mill Road.
Mm-hmm.
Over in the cafeteria or the coffee shop area, they have a big mural up on the wall, and it runs the entire length of that coffee shop, and it's famous authors. And it galls me that in Richland County in Ontario / Mansfield, the Barnes & Noble does not have Louis Brumfield on that wall.
Why? Have you asked them why?
Yes, and this is what really puts the icing on the cake.
I knew
we'd get
there.
The people that run the bookstore didn't know who Lloyd Brumfield
was. Oh, my goodness.
Can you imagine?
Well, I guess I can, yes.
and here's another one for you. My wife and I went to one of the programs they had down at the library a couple of years ago before COVID hit, before they started the book sale. They've taken over the area where they used to have these programs, but it was like a little auditorium. And they would have guest speakers in. In fact, a friend of mine did one on Malabar over there a couple of years ago. But we went this day because it was highlighting movies from 1939, which was, of course, the year Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind and all those came out. Biggest year ever for Hollywood blockbusters.
Yeah,
and
I believe
that. He was a professor of... a movie professor. Now they have movies. You know, you can take classes on movies in college now.
I have.
He's become a professor of movies, movie history, from Bowling Green State University. And, of course, he opened his program with all of these movie posters up here on, he had an overhead projector with all these movie posters of all these big movies from 1939. As I'm scanning the posters, I don't see the Rains game up there.
Huh.
So I thought, well, I'll wait and see what he talks about. So all through his talk, he's talking about all these movies, especially Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz, because they were Oscar winners.
Yeah.
But he never mentions The Rains King, which won the Oscar for special effects, and he never mentions Lloyd Brumfield. So at the end of the program, I went up to him and I said, I want to ask you a question. I said, does the name Lloyd Brumfield mean anything to you?
Don't tell me he said
no.
Who? Oh, my goodness.
So this is movies and literature. He was also an assistant professor of literature. Heard of him.
My favorite...
I explained to him who he was and told him what he's accomplished in his lifetime and where he was from, he got really red in the face.
I'm sure he did.
He was totally unprepared for an answer. And I told him, I said, when you go home, you Google Louis Brumfield or Malabar Farm, and you read him a little more about him.
Yeah.
Because you need to include him in your program, especially the range game.
Especially if he's right here in this state. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, now, you mentioned now that they have cinema classes. When I was in college, I took a course, two semesters. I took, I was an actor, so I really wanted to find out about it. But some of the greatest films I had never heard of, along the lines of Citizen Kane and stuff like that, you have never heard of them, came from the German films in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Fantastic stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
You did have to use your own creative mind to, you know, get along with some of the things they were saying, but great films. Yeah.
Well, one comes to mind is The Grand Hotel.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Which came out, I think, in the 30s, yeah. 20s, early 30s. It was talkie. But a picture like that, a marvelous picture, absolutely fantastic picture, but people don't know anything about it.
Who was the female star in that?
Oh, you know, I knew you were going to ask. I can't remember whether it was Garbo or somebody
like
that.
Yeah, very famous, yeah.
Yeah, very, very famous individual at that time. And really, honestly, the only place you can see those movies now is, of course, on TMC, Turner Tudor Movie Classics.
Oh, yeah.
And which is one of my absolute favorite stations on television. So much garbage on TV.
Yeah,
today it's hard to find anything good. But on TMC, they show all those classics, and I especially like this past weekend because they dedicated the entire weekend to war movies, and basically most of them were produced in the 40s and early 50s, right after World War II. And, of course, one of my other all-time favorites they showed this weekend was Sergeant York.
Oh, yeah.
Gary Cooper.
My father met Sergeant York.
But it really irritated me that this guy, who was a professor of literature and movies, knew nothing about Louis Brumfield from his home state of Ohio.
Wow, that's pretty wild.
Hey, maybe we can do a show sometime on movies, on classic movies.
Why don't we do it soon?
we can do it this month if you want. I can always postpone my history thing until next
Sure.
Week.
We've got a show in 2 weeks, 2 weeks from today.
Yeah, and I was going to give you a call on the off the radio, but I'll just mention it here. There may be a possibility I have to move that to the fourth Thursday if you don't have anybody.
Okay, are there five Thursdays in the month?
I'm not sure whether there are. When does James usually come on?
The last Thursday of the month.
Okay, so maybe I might have to move it up a Thursday.
Okay, well, that would be fine, too.
I'll double-check the calendar. We may have to do some help with the in-laws.
That would be fine.
I'll see how things go, but I'll let you know off the air on that. Give you a call at home.
All right. Fred Malone, he does our show every third Thursday.
Usually the third Thursday, yeah. But I just wanted to mention that about Brumfield because he is a famous author, and he's right here from Ohio. He ranks right up there, well, really, with Thurber and people like that.
We ought to know him.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Hey, have a great day, Glenn.
Thanks, Fred.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Fred Malone, he does a great show with us. He helps me out at third Thursday of every month. He comes on and does history. Oh, he knows everything. I mean, truly, he knows a ton about a ton. He knows stuff about critters. And the following week, we usually do James Anderson, who is the naturalist from Marion. And Fred jumps on the line and talks to us about, you know, salamanders and stuff. So Fred's a very smart man, and I really enjoy talking with him. And he's a nice guy to boot. That, you know, that sometimes you don't get both of those things. Anyway, yes, Louis Brumfield. We ought to remember that name, those of us who live here in Ohio. Now, I consider myself, unfortunately, I guess, I consider myself a Hoosier because I was born in Indianapolis and lived there for the first third of my life. But I've been pretty much gotten here. I kind of feel myself as being from Ohio now. Took me a while, but I kind of do. All right. We were kind of talking about, we were talking about interesting facts about writers. And again, I'll remind you that, excuse me, Christopher Coble, my son, my eldest son, will be coming on at 11:15 and talking about his writing experience and also about how maybe you could get into self-publishing, which Christopher's published now 11 novels, I believe that it is. So maybe he can give you some hints. And you're welcome. You can't call in then, but you're more than welcome to call me next week and ask me questions, and I will pass them along to Christopher. All right. Let's see here. Okay, we did the one about Poirot. A young Samuel Johnson was turned down for a teaching job because it was feared of his way of distorting his face. Oh, I already read that. He'd scare the kids by distorting his face. Oh, well. Charles Dickens gave himself a number of nicknames. Now, I did not know this. Dickens gave himself a bunch of names, including the Sparkler of Albion, the Intimitable, that's a hard word for me to say, the Intimitable, Revolver, and Resurrectionist. Dickens gave himself those names. Okay, sounds like I have to read a little deeper into Charles Dickens. On his marriage document in 1582, William Shakespeare's name was spelled William Shagspere. S-H-A-G-S-P-E-A-R-E. William Shagspere. Interesting. But that's what... Well, apparently he signed it that way. I don't know. J.D. Salinger once dated Ona, who is the daughter of playwright Eugene O'Neill. But she gave him up for Charles Chaplin, who she later married. Now, Charlie Chaplin had a very, how would you say it, a wide and diverse romantic life. He was, I think he married several people and wasn't real faithful all the time. I guess a lot of I love watching his acting. His acting now, I think you will admit with me that he overacts, but he's not really overacting. That's just his style of acting. And one of my favorite soliloquies is the speech by the dictator at the end of the movie called The Dictator, where he talks about he does not want to be a dictator. He doesn't want to ruin people's lives and so forth and so on. I've read it on the air, and it always makes me, not cry, but it always makes me my heart hurt for people that are subject to dictators and that sort of thing. All right, Mickey Spillane. You remember the name Mickey Spillane? Mystery writer ordered 50,000 copies of his 1952 novel, Kiss Me, Deadly. He ordered 50,000 copies of Kiss Me, Deadly to be destroyed when a comma was left out of the title. Now, you can understand why he'd want that comma there, Kiss Me, Deadly, is different than Kiss Me, Deadly. He ordered 50,000 copies and destroyed them. He obviously had made some money prior to this. Okay. The first U.S. edition of Ian Fleming's novel, Casino Royale, was published with the title, You Asked for It. That was the title of Casino Royale. I'm trying to remember. I know I've seen Casino Royale, but I don't remember it. I'm going to have to look at it again and see why he would have had on there You Asked for It as the title as opposed to Casino Royale. All right, well, it's about 10:58. We're just about ready to jump off the air for about 15 minutes, and we hope you'll join us back here at quarter after. We'll have my eldest son, Christopher Coble, who is an author. He's also an administrator at a university down in Columbus. But he has published 11 books. And we're going to talk about how do you get yourself self-published. We're going to talk about his books so that you can get on. You can buy them on Amazon. They're not very expensive. My wife has bought every one of them. And we'll talk about it and see if maybe he can give you some hints. I could bring him on my show, A Progressive Life, because he is very opinionated on his political side. Some of you wouldn't like it. He tends to be on my side of the aisle, even more closely to his mother's side of the aisle. She's a little further left than I am. But anyway, we'll have him on, and we're not going to talk politics. We're going to talk about publishing. We're going to talk about writing books. We're going to talk about how you self-publish. We're going to talk about his novels, and we'll just have a good old time. Maybe we'll bring in some family information. I don't know. He's the only writer in my family, by the way, other than myself. We'll talk at quarter after. Stay tuned and get the news coming up here in about 5 seconds, and come back and listen to me interview my son.
You're listening to WWGH Radio, LP Marion, Ohio, The Talking Place, 107.1 FM. From Charlie Evers.
You know, you could come in handy, too, with that electricity if we have problems with our transmitter, which is